imagine if everything you said when you were 15 years old was used in deciding whether you could get into college or get your job. Well, that's what's happening today. We're seeing colleges turn against kids who, when they were 15 years old, made statements that they now regret, rescinding their acceptances, telling them they're not welcome on the college. These are schools that claim they want diversity, and they're not even prepared to forgive a 15-year-old for what she or he may have said when they were basically immature. That's not the American way. You'll hear why on The Dirt Show. I hope everybody had meaningful holidays, and I hope the new year brings us a better year than the past one. Today, I want to talk about what is going on in college admissions and how college admissions are being revoked for young people who said things when they were 14, 15, 16 years old that were captured on videotape and social media and are now either being expelled from school, having their admissions rescinded, or having pressure placed on them to withdraw their admissions applications because of things they said when they were very, very young. You know, when I grew up in the 1950s, kids were encouraged to turn in their parents if their parents had said anything that suggests they may be communists or fellow travelers or pinkos. And if the kids turned in their parents to principals, sometimes even to local police, they were treated as heroes, turning in their own parents because at the dinner table, they may have said something positive about communism, even while communism was fighting against, obviously, fascism and Nazism. Today, we're seeing a repetition of that. Kids are being made into heroes because they rat out their friends, because they turn them in, because they expose what they may have said in the locker room or on the internet or on other social media. A number of cases have prominently brought this phenomenon to public attention. The New York Times reported just a couple of days ago about a young woman. She was 15 years old, and she listened to a lot of rap music. And you know, rap music uses the N-word repeatedly, just repeatedly. It's one of the most common things done in rap music. And you know, when you listen to African-American people talking among themselves on television, you hear them use the N-word repeatedly. She was a white girl, 15 years old, influenced by that music. And she put a 3-second video on in which she said, "I'm driving now," and then use the N-word to kind of emphasize that. Well, nothing happened when she was 15, and she grew up, and she turned 16 and 17 and 18, and she became a strong supporter of Black Lives Matter and a strong supporter of racial equality in a school which had a long history of racial inequality. And then she applied and got admitted to the University of Tennessee and was placed on the cheerleading squad. She had been a champion cheerleader. And then a friend of hers, somebody she didn't know well, but a friend of hers in the class, in her class in high school, decided, no, he had to turn her in. And so he took the 3-second video and sent it around and went viral. And then I don't know whether it was he or other people in the class who notified University of Tennessee that she had said this when she was 15. She tried to explain that these were just song lyrics. These were words that were commonly used in her school, kind of in back and forth banter. She now realizes how wrong it was. She has made complete amends, and she's now a very strong supporter of equal rights and Black Lives Matter. Didn't matter to the University of Tennessee. They wrote her a letter saying, unless you rescind your own application and withdraw it, we will rescind it. She then did withdraw it. Her parents, who were apparently active in civil rights and civil liberties, realized that the daughter had made a terrible mistake at 15. Who doesn't make mistakes at 15? And decided not to contest it. Had they contested it, they probably would have won. because the University of Tennessee is a public university, and therefore it's bound by the First Amendment. And the N-word, no matter what you think of it, is protected speech, protected by the First Amendment. If it wasn't, you wouldn't have rap music. You wouldn't have a lot of other music that uses that word, in other words, fairly frequently. But she withdrew, and she's now, instead of being a cheerleader at the University of Tennessee, she's now taking night courses at a community college. It really, in effect, has potentially ruined her life because of something she did when she was 15 years old. Harvard has a similar story. A young man, 16, a Jewish Russian immigrant, was involved in a website exchange of some kind in which they were trying to show how outrageous they could be, and they engaged in racist talk and Holocaust denial and anti-Semitic talk just to see who could be more outrageous. Again, this was years and years earlier. He had totally turned himself around, got admitted to Harvard, but then it turned out that he was a Republican, a Trump supporter. He was a survivor of one of the shooting massacres, and most of the other survivors favored gun control. He took a different view. He said, no, I'm in favor of more guns, less gun control. That's the way to prevent these kinds of killings in schools. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think he's dead wrong. But he had his Harvard admission rescinded as the result of it. This is becoming rampant all over the country and all over many, many universities. And some of the statements are, you know, not just the N-word. They're statements of opinion, wrong-headed often. I'll just read you a couple of them from an article that was written about this recently. While many students are speaking out against racial injustice, others have made statements in defense of Derek Chauvin, the police officer charged with Floyd's murder, promoted violent acts against protesters, and said black people should, quote, get over it. In America, you're allowed to be a racist as long as you don't act on it, tweeted, and then it names the kid, who was set to attend Xavier University. And his admission was rescinded for expressing those points of view. Now, those points of view are expressed all the time in private conversation. You wouldn't want to have everything you've ever said in the locker room broadcast to the colleges of your choice. And by the way, I would only imagine that equally bigoted statements are made by people of every race and every racial background. We know that these statements are made. The difference is some people are foolish enough to have the statements recorded or to put them on the internet. And that's the new phenomenon. When I was growing up during McCarthyism, you had to turn in your parents, but you were just quoting them. There was no evidence that they said it. Well, maybe you found some evidence. Maybe you found a letter or something like that, and you turned them in for that. But that would be the old version of today's internet. Today, anything that's posted on Facebook, anything that's put on Twitter, anything that's put on any social media can inevitably come back to haunt you. I remember when I was teaching at Harvard Law School, the first day of my first class in September of every class I would teach first year criminal law, I would warn my students that whatever they now say, they're professionals, whatever they now put in writing can be searched for and used against them when they seek job applications. I also told them in those days, even if they use marijuana in college, they had to stop using it in law school because they're now professionals. And the bar application would ask whether you've committed any crimes. And using marijuana back in the day was a crime. Today it still is in many jurisdictions and not in other jurisdictions. By the way, it is still a crime to smoke marijuana and to sell marijuana or buy marijuana anywhere in the United States. That may surprise you, but it's a federal crime. Although it's not enforced, it's a federal crime. And even if you live in a state in which it's completely legal, in which there are open stores that sell it and make money, it's still potentially a federal criminal offense because the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution gives federal criminal law dominance over state criminal law. That's peripheral. Let's get back to the issue of modern-day McCarthyism. When I was growing up, we had a word for kids that turned in other kids. We called them rats, or rats in training, or young rats. We didn't make them heroes, but today, they're heroes. The kid who turned in the 15-year-old girl is a hero. Articles are written about him. He's very happy. He's very content with what he did. He's proud of what he did. Well, not in my book, not in my way of looking at things. To my mind, he's a rat. And we shouldn't be encouraging this kind of behavior. He says, I'm going to remind myself. You started something, he said with satisfaction. You taught someone a lesson. Well, turn that back to the days of McCarthyism. You could say the same thing. You taught somebody a lesson. Don't be a communist. Don't say anything that's supportive of the left. Don't say anything that's supportive of Russia. Don't say anything that's supportive of anybody you disagree with. You take this to its logical conclusion, and what do you have? Well, nobody takes it to its logical conclusion. We have a double standard, and the double standard applies largely against white young kids who have made racist comments against black people or black young kids or Black Lives Matter. When the shoe is on the other foot, when you have African-American kids making comparable statements about whitey or about honkies or about rednecks or anything of the sort, I don't think we're going to see kids having their applications rejected. If schools want to have the power to reject applications, they have to have written standards, and it has to be a singular standard, and it has to lay it out in advance. Harvard should tell every applicant, here are things you can't say or think, I guess, or put on the internet or talk about, and if you do, we'll rescind your application. And then we have to have a list of things, and they have to be race neutral. And they have to be gender neutral, and they have to be neutral in every other respect. Schools would never pass such a rule. They want to have discretion. They want to be able to be politically correct. You know, they say they're looking for diversity. What could be more diversifying than admitting a couple of kids who expressed racist views when they were 14, 15, 16 years old, and now have changed their minds, or even if they didn't change their minds, let's assume they still had racist views. Why does that not add to diversity? Since when do universities have the right to say which views are acceptable, which views are not, particularly public universities, which are bound by the First Amendment? This is a very delicate issue, and it's being handled very poorly by universities. It's part of our cancel culture. The kid from Harvard who got his admission rescinded was canceled by Harvard. I don't know where he went to. He actually called me on the phone when this happened and expressed to me how much he had changed his mind. And in fact, some people at Harvard who were actively involved in diversity training, etc., wanted him to be a student because he would be a good example to other students of how you can change your attitudes and how you can change your minds. He actually wrote a very thoughtful letter to Harvard in which he said, look, you acknowledge that people can change their mind. Here's what he said. This is what he said in an interview. Throughout its history, Harvard faculty has included slave owners, segregationists, bigots, and anti-Semites, including the president of Harvard back in the day. If Harvard is suggesting that growth isn't possible and that our past defines our future, then Harvard is an inherently racist institution. But I don't believe that. I believe that institutions and people can grow. He's right. He's absolutely right. People can change. But they shouldn't be changed as the result of compulsion by the university. If a student is a brilliant math student and has views that are out of sync with our current correct views on racial equality, that shouldn't be a disqualifying factor. Let's remember that a professor named Shockley was a very prominent professor at Stanford, won the Nobel Prize for inventing the transistor. And as he got older, he began to develop views which many regarded as racist. He based them on biology. He called them dysgenics. And he tried to prove in a scientific manner something that I think my own view is poppycock, but he believed it. And they couldn't fire him because he had tenure, but they surely wouldn't have admitted him as a student, and Stanford would have missed having as a student one of the most brilliant scientists who won the Nobel Prize. We have to start thinking hard about what diversity means, what criteria for admissions mean, and what power a university should have over the minds and the words of students. I lived through McCarthyism. I remember it very well. Brooklyn College was called the Little Red Schoolhouse. It had been a center of communist agitation in the 1930s and 40s until they brought to the presidency of Harvard a very brilliant anti-communist who cleaned the school out of communism, but at a tremendous, tremendous cost. Free speech was very much restricted in the days when Harry Giddens was the president of Brooklyn College. I was the student body president, so I remember vividly having conflicts with him over time about the limits of free speech. He believed that nobody should be able to express communist views on the campus because of its history. I believe that all views should be expressed and people should choose in the open marketplace of ideas. In those days, you couldn't select students based on ideology because Brooklyn College admitted you based solely on your grade point average and your score on a test. Everything was done just routinely. There were no interviews. There were no statements that you had to write about why you should be admitted to the school. So the school did contain a broad array of different views from extreme right to extreme left that made for great intellectual diversity. Schools today don't want diversity. They want racial diversity, they want gender diversity, they want sexual orientation diversity, but they don't want intellectual diversity. Within a certain range of ideas, they accept intellectual diversity, but the very fact that they would turn away students who at the ages of 14, 15, and 16 expressed views that we all find obnoxious, but kids express obnoxious views. And so I'm very much opposed to what's going on in university admissions today. I'm very much opposed to what's going on many university campuses. The cancel culture is becoming the American culture. That's why I wrote a book about it. I wrote a book called Cancel Culture, the newest attack on free speech and due process, and may I add, on meritocracy. I hope you'll read it, and I hope you'll call me and comment about what you think is going on today on college and university campuses. I hope the next year brings us more tolerance, more acceptance, more willingness to forgive, less political correctness, and less cancellation. You won't hear anybody canceled on the Durst Show. Let's turn now to questions and comments from our wonderful listeners and viewers. Our first call is from Mike in New Orleans.
I have a constitutional question in regards to the DA from New York who ran on a platform of prosecuting Trump before she knew there was a crime. You've said before that is unconstitutional. You can't do that. Pick the crime and I'll find you the man type of thing. Or find the man and I'll pick the crime. What happens in the instance where you have it on record that someone was intentionally targeting an individual for prosecution before there was a known crime? What is the legal course for that? Do the charges get thrown out? Does it go to court anyway? Does the case get moved? Is it fruit of the poisonous tree and the whole thing goes away? What happens with that whole scenario if charges are actually brought from that DA? Thanks. Love the show.
Great question. And there's no simple answer. I can tell you what I would do as a lawyer if it were one of my clients. I would immediately move to recuse and seek the appointment of a special prosecutor who is unbiased and didn't run for office and isn't seeking office in the future. The idea of being prosecuted by somebody who campaigned on the promise to go after you is just so un-American, I believe unconstitutional. And therefore, I would certainly move to recuse. If you don't move to recuse and if there's a conviction, you can then challenge that conviction. I know that that issue was raised in the Bill Cosby case. I don't know if it was raised in the briefs or how it was litigated, but the DA there surely did run. Now, there they knew about the crime in advance, and there had been a hung jury or there had been a refusal to prosecute. In any event, they knew about the crime. Here, in the Trump situation, they simply assume there must be something wrong. We can find something wrong. A friend of mine, Harvey Silvergay, wrote this great book called Three Felonies a Day, in which he shows that virtually anybody who is involved in complicated commercial business has committed three felonies a day. And it's a matter of prosecutorial discretion. And when prosecutors run in order to find the crime, that is so un-American and so inconsistent with the values of our Constitution that I hope the voters of New York would reject this prosecutor. But after all, New York is very anti-Trump as well. So maybe it was a good campaign issue for her, but it's not good for the criminal justice system. Our next call is from Bob in Florida.
Alan, my name is Bob Plotkin from Palm City, Florida. Thank you for the most educational podcast I've ever heard, and I don't miss an episode. My question concerns the pocket veto. Can you explain exactly what that is and how this may be used to affect the current stimulus and COVID bills that have been passed now? And I guess they're waiting for a signature from the president. Also, what is your opinion of a 5,000-page-plus bill going to vote within hours of Congress being able to read the bill? Thank you.
Let me begin with your second question. I think it's unconstitutional for Congress to vote on a bill they haven't read. Congress has the power to enact legislation, not just to vote yes or no on legislation that was essentially enacted by committees. I think it's an outrage that you ever have a bill voted on without it being read by every member of Congress. You know, it's interesting. When Justice Brandeis was on the Supreme Court, he said, this is a different institution than Congress. Here we do our own work. Even though they had law clerks, the justices wrote their opinions and did all the research. That's not true of Congress. Staff members do a considerable amount of their work, and it's wrong. Under the Constitution, basically, there are two ways a president can veto a bill. Either he can simply write the word veto, or he can essentially refuse to sign the bill. And then there's a whole process by which, if he refuses to sign, a certain amount of days have to pass, etc. President Trump did today, or last night perhaps, sign the stimulus bill reluctantly. I think he was right to object to $600 and was right to call for $2,000. I probably would have called for even a little bit more than that. At a time of economic suffering all over the country, I think we have to have a stimulus, but it has to be targeted. The idea that David Boies' law firm, Boies makes millions of dollars every year, average partner makes $3 million a year, and they applied for stimulus relief? Come on. And the government gives it to them, and the mom and pop shop that has to go out of business gets no relief? They should be subject to the takings clause. When the government says to a small business, you have to close, the government should have to pay for that. Stop paying David Boies and start paying mom and pop stores that have been in the family for years. The New York Times had a story about all these little businesses that are going out of business, including a bar in Cambridge that I used to go to once or twice, the Cantab Bar in Cambridge, is going out of business. And that's the people who ought to be getting relief, not the David Boieses of the world or the large corporations. They can afford to sell the yacht, sell their farms, sell their fifth homes and their seventh car, and maybe contribute to the national interest rather than just taking. So I'm glad the stimulus bill has been signed. I'd like to see the amount raised to $2,000 or $3,000, but hey, even a little bit helps. Let's turn now to our next caller.
Hello. I listened to your show with Jason Goodman, and I didn't like you call him idiot. That's why he was banned. You were banned, but you did the bad thing, even worse. You blocked him from YouTube. You said you're such a good lawyer, and that, you know, Alice. Everybody's, you know, you're Democrat. I got so upset that you're doing these things. Democrat. You're Democratic Party, and you Democrats are demons. You don't allow people to live, to breathe. Terrible what you did. Such a good lawyer.
Well, thank you for your call. I didn't ban him from YouTube. I don't want him to be banned from YouTube. I don't want anybody to be banned from YouTube. Yes, I did say he was essentially a crackpot. He is a crackpot. He urged people not to wear masks and not to socially distance and not to take vaccines. That is dangerous, and that's a crackpot idea. Look, the vaccines, I don't think there is a basis for not taking it, but reasonable people maybe can disagree about whether it should be taken now or you wait a little bit of time. But masks, what's the downside of wearing masks? When he started to tell his people, his viewers, his listeners, not to wear masks, I didn't want to be associated with him. I did not want to be on that show, and I will never again be on that show, because that's a crackpot idea. Everybody should wear a mask, and everybody should socially distance. There's no harm in doing that. And the idea that he would be urging people to endanger my life, your life, the lives of your children, family members, to have a podcast that appeals to extremists. No, that's a crackpot idea. And so I probably should have said crackpot instead of idiot, but he's both. Let's turn now to our last call.
Hi, thanks. I really enjoy your show, but I have a comment about your suggestion to have an impartial group, I think you called it a VIP or something like that, to assess the validity of elections. And while I don't think it's a bad idea, but I think it might be a good idea, but if this organization existed, as you proposed, this year, and they came out and said that there was no significant election fraud, I think it's naive to think that that Trump and his supporters would just accept that, even if someone as respectable as yourself were on the committee. He would simply accuse the group of being part of the deep state or secretly working for Democrats. Fox and OAN would support that, and all of his followers would blindly go along, no matter how respectable the group is. I imagine that even yourself would come on the Durst Show and argue that, well, this organization, while respectable and great, has no constitutional basis and therefore has no authority in the process. And therefore, I'm not sure what that group would accomplish. Appreciate hearing your thoughts. Again, this is Gary from Miami.
Great question. And your points make a lot of sense. I think the virtue of such a commission, the VIP, Voter Integrity Panel, would be to be a substitute for CNN and Fox. Today you have dueling perspectives in the media. They have no official government imprimatur or power either. But it would be the Walter Cronkite phenomenon. When Walter Cronkite got on the air and said something, people believed it. I think if you had a commission of five or six or eight or nine Walter Cronkites, people who are above reproach, Republicans, Democrats, pro-Trump people, anti-Trump people, men, women, people of various backgrounds, racially, ethnically, religiously, scientifically, I do think that it would narrow the debate. Yeah, you're going to get some people, obviously, who will never accept any report on both sides. But I think the vast majority of Americans are interested in learning the truth. and they're skeptical about whether they can get the truth today from the New York Times. New York Times used to be the paper of record, no more. It is no longer today accepted that what the New York Times reports is necessarily true and unbiased. And that's why I really do think a commission would be helpful. It would also be able to evaluate particular claims, and both before the election, during the election, and after the election. Is it a cure-all? Is it a panacea? Of course not. Would it contribute a little bit to helping bring us together and narrow the enormous distance between people's perspectives on facts? I think it would. I hope this show does that. I hope this show helps narrow a bit, because I'm not biased in favor of one side or the other. I'm a liberal Democrat who defended President Trump in front of the Senate, as I defended Bill Clinton 20 years earlier in consulting with his legal team. So I hope this show helps to bridge those gaps and helps bring together people in the middle, right center, left center. It's not going to change the minds of extremists on either side who are fixed in their views. But if you have an open mind, keep listening to The Dear Show. Let's turn now to our last call.
Hi, thanks. I really enjoy your show, but I have a comment about your suggestion to have an impartial group. I think you called it a VIP or something like that, to assess the validity of elections. And while I don't think it's a bad idea, but I think it might be a good idea. But if this organization existed, as you proposed, this year, and they came out and said that there was no significant election fraud, I think it's naive to think that that Trump and his supporters would just accept that, even if someone as respectable as yourself were on the committee. He would simply accuse the group of being part of the deep state or secretly working for Democrats. Fox and OAN would support that, and all of his followers would blindly go along, no matter how respectable the group is. I imagine that even yourself would come on the Dear Show and argue that, well, this organization, while respectable and great, has no constitutional basis and therefore has no authority in the process. And therefore, I'm not sure what that group would accomplish. Appreciate hearing your thoughts. Again, this is Gary from Miami.
Great question. And your points make a lot of sense. I think the virtue of such a commission, the VIP, Voter Integrity Panel, would be to be a substitute for CNN and Fox. Today you have dueling perspectives in the media. They have no official government imprimatur or power either. But it would be the Walter Cronkite phenomenon. When Walter Cronkite got on the air and said something, people believed it. I think if you had a commission of five or six or eight or nine Walter Cronkites, people who are above reproach, Republicans, Democrats, pro-Trump people, anti-Trump people, men, women, people of various backgrounds, racially, ethnically, religiously, scientifically, I do think that it would narrow the debate. Yeah, you're going to get some people, obviously, who will never accept any report on both sides. But I think the vast majority of Americans are interested in learning the truth. And they're skeptical about whether they can get the truth today from the New York Times. New York Times used to be the paper of record, no more. It is no longer today accepted that what the New York Times reports is necessarily true and unbiased. And that's why I really do think a commission would be helpful. It would also be able to evaluate particular claims, and both before the election, during the election, and after the election. Is it a cure-all? Is it a panacea? Of course not. Would it contribute a little bit to helping bring us together and narrow the enormous distance between people's perspectives on facts? I think it would. I hope this show does that. I hope this show helps narrow a bit, because I'm not biased in favor of one side or the other. I'm a liberal Democrat who defended President Trump in front of the Senate, as I defended Bill Clinton 20 years earlier in consulting with his legal team. So I hope this show helps to bridge those gaps and helps bring together people in the middle, right center, left center. It's not going to change the minds of extremists on either side who are fixed in their views. But if you have an open mind, keep listening to The Dirt Show.